cash, every movie costs $2,184.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Backtracks Theme Music. My name is Corey Morissette, joined as always by my good buddy John Mariano. How are you doing tonight, John?
Put me in, coach. I'm ready to play.
Oh, we're doing center field. Oh, hey, I love John Fogerty.
I'm so excited. We are bringing all my loves together tonight, Corey. Like everything I love in the world, including Corey Morissette, are on the show tonight. And my Lord, how did we come up with a show where we could talk about movies, music, fucking Journey, fucking Brad Pitt, and baseball?
Aaron Sorkin, if you like dialogue-heavy scripts.
I love me some Aaron Sorkin. I love his TV work. I love his movie work. I love his character work. Give me all the Aaron Sorkin.
That's right. If you haven't guessed by the title of the podcast or from Johnny's description, it's his pick. I've been monopolizing the picks lately, so I'm letting John do the next couple here. And he's got baseball fever. So he picked, we're going all the way back to 2011, and Moneyball, the film written by Aaron Sorkin and Steve Zaillian, directed by Bennett Miller, who also directed the film Foxcatcher. One of my favorite movies about baseball. John, maybe tell us a little bit about Moneyball.
Yeah, look, if I know we talk about movies here, but I'm going to talk about real life. In real life, around the year 2000, but for much of his career, Billy Beane was the general manager. He's still the general manager of the Oakland A's 20 years later, right? And Billy Beane was given zero budget to work with. Very infamously, the owner of the Oakland A's operates on a shoestring to no budget. And Billy Beane has to figure it out. So what he figures out with Moneyball is that there are values of players that other teams don't value. So if teams are valuing speed and power hitting, you value getting on base and fielding, right? And you can still field a great team over 162 games that wins a lot of games if you're valuing what other teams aren't. And that's the whole concept of Moneyball. There's also stuff where they get into statistics, and we'll get into a little bit more of that as we talk about the movie. But Billy Beane writes this book called Moneyball, and it becomes really, really popular. And Aaron Sorkin picks it up and makes a movie out of it, starring Brad Pitt. Some of the stuff's true. Some of the stuff's a little bit Hollywoodized. But overall, there's a great way of explaining how the game has changed. And that's really what the movie's about.
And you mentioned the book real quick. The author of the book is Michael Lewis. He's written a couple of other books that were turned into pretty successful films. Do you know him offhand?
No clue.
Well, the first one is a little football movie called The Blind Side.
Ooh.
That won Sandra Bullock an Academy Award. The other film won Adam McKay an Academy Award in 2015. Do you know that one?
Oh, that's the Christian Bale one. Mm-hmm. Why can't I think of the name? I know I'm going to kick myself when you say it. It's about the housing crisis.
It is. The Big Short.
The Big Short. Thank you. I'm like, I can describe the movie to you.
Well, you pretty much did. It's Christian Bale and the housing crisis. That's all you need.
It's a great ensemble cast.
And yes.
Bale, you know, he doesn't even lead the ensemble, but, you know, as Bale is one to do, has a role for the ages because he just becomes the character. And he, with the limited screen time, makes a major impact in that movie.
And as we mentioned, The Big Short, automatically what popped in my head was we got to do The Big Short because When the Levee Breaks by Led Zeppelin plays over the end credits of The Big Short. And it fits that movie so well.
That's another reason to do another Zeppelin song. You're on a roll tonight, Corey.
I tell you, but we're talking Moneyball. We're talking Brad Pitt. And you mentioned statistics. And that's what kind of sets apart baseball and Moneyball from other sports. And that you mentioned how they value players was differently. And that was the whole crux of the Jonah Hill character. Because his whole thing is it's all about runs. nothing else matters. It's all about runs. That's how you win games. So you want guys with high on base percentages. Chris Pratt's character got walked all the time. So they signed him for next to nothing. Just get walked. Do what you naturally do.
So Chris Pratt's character is journeyman infielder Scott Hedberg,
mm-hmm.
who I play a lot of fantasy baseball. So this is really pulling all my loves together. And Scott Hedberg is not anybody you would ever draft in fantasy baseball because he wasn't a player that you fantasized about. There was nothing sexy about him. But he was a guy that when you watched the game, you really respected and wanted on your team. He was a good hard-nosed player that knew how to get on base, knew how to generate runs. There are little things in baseball that you don't get credit for, like moving runners over, right? Which I don't know that Moneyball itself values, which is where I have a bone to pick, not just with this movie, but with this concept.
All right.
So if you can entertain me for a minute, Corey, I need to get something out of my system here.
The floor is yours, my friend. Go ahead.
Where I feel like the concept of Moneyball falls apart for me is baseball is very much an art form, and they try to turn it into something quantifiable, something analytics driven, something more like football. And as we learned from the great George Carlin, there are many differences between baseball and football. And he does it in a mocking way to say that football is better than baseball. But it also highlights baseball is more of an art form. Like, it can go on forever. We don't care when it ends. You know, football is played on a gridiron. Baseball is played on a field, right? Like, all these kind of rants he does. And Moneyball tries to take that concept and say, you know what? You can measure baseball. And what it's done is it's changed the way the game has inherently been played because other teams picked up on this. And games have gotten longer. And managers make more changes and they do more defensive shifts and they do all these kinds of things that take the art out of the game. And we might talk, you know, in a week or two, we might talk about another baseball movie that relies heavily on managers managing from the gut and players playing from the gut, right? And movies that come to mind right away are movies like Bull Durham, mm-hmm. right? Movies like Major League. You know, maybe we'll cover one of these movies in a couple of weeks and we can talk about that. But here we're talking about Moneyball, and Moneyball really gets into, you know, coaches in a room with a whiteboard trying to discuss how they get pitchers who give up less runs and hitters who score more runs. And if you give up a hitter who hits 40 home runs, you don't need one 40 home run hitter. But if he had 140 RBIs, it's like, where are you generating those RBIs from? Right. And it's like, oh, we can get it from three different positions. Right. And that's how Moneyball kind of works. And it's just not as fun, Corey. Like, let's be real. The movie is great. The movie does a great job of explaining this. It's very well done. It takes you through Billy Beane's emotions during the season. It takes you through this underdog story of this team that has no budget, right? The movie does a great job. I'm not shitting on the movie at all. I love this movie. I hate the fucking concept that this movie instills as like, this is the way to do things because it's boring.
Yeah, and there definitely needs to have that, like you mentioned, those gut instincts in baseball. It's happening now in football, too. All these new coaches are analytic-driven. They don't call it Moneyball so much, but they go by the analytics, when to go for it on fourth and five, when not to. A lot of times, those have to be gut decisions. Whenever you try and play it analytically like that, it inevitably fails.
Right, and there are conditions that statistics don't figure out. Like, it doesn't take emotion into account.
Right. Momentum.
Right. Like, by all accounts, an injured pitcher shouldn't be on the mound in a World Series.
Mm-hmm.
Shouldn't be in the mound in the playoffs. Right. But, and as a Yankee fan, I'm going to say it this way. Curt Schilling's fucking bloody sock will haunt my nightmares for the rest of my fucking life. Right. And there's nothing statistically that says he should have been in that game at that point. Right. Statistically, they probably would have pulled him and brought in five other relievers to like work out the game. But the legend and the history are what they are, right? Because of that, there are so many great moments that hitters and pitchers who shouldn't have gotten at bats for one reason or another were in the game and made a legendary play. And those stories aren't going to exist for our kids and grandkids because the game isn't played that way anymore.
A movie you mentioned, Major League. Imagine that entire game, but imagine like the last inning played under Moneyball type analytics.
I can tell you right now, one thing Moneyball doesn't like is bunting. And the final play of that movie, spoiler alert, is Jake Taylor laying down a beautiful bunt and legging it out in the most dramatic way possible. And that doesn't happen with Moneyball.
Amen.
But we're not here to talk about what Moneyball isn't or why the concept of it sucks. We're here to talk about why this movie is great and why the song's even greater.
Because holy cow, we're talking about, one of the biggest rock songs of all time. Don't Stop Believing. This song is so recognizable. Everybody knows this song. It was a top 10 worldwide hit all the way back in 1981. Just last year, the song was selected by the Library of Congress for preservation in the United States National Recording Registry as being culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant, which begs the question, what took so long? That should have maybe happened 20 years ago.
People are slow on the gun on these things, Corey. I'm just happy it's been recognized. One of the most recognizable, one of the biggest karaoke songs out there. Steve Perry is a fucking legend. And this song is one of the signature reasons why.
He's also my favorite sports taunt. If you watched basketball, whenever they tried to psych somebody out, they would just go, Steve Perry. So I still do that to people. I'll just break up or sing Oh Sherry or something, or just break out the odd Steve Perry.
That's so great. I totally forgot about that gag in that movie. And way to keep it on brand for the episode, Corey.
Oh, thank you. All right, what do you say we go all the way back to 1981? This is Journey from the album Escape. Don't Stop Believing. Before we get into the classic Steve Perry vocals there, that's Jonathan Cain on the keyboards. This was his first album with Journey. Their old keyboard player, Greg Rolle, he had left the group and actually recommended Jonathan Cain take his place in Journey. And Jonathan Cain shares songwriting credits with Steve Perry and Neil Sean. And I only bring it up because right now Jonathan Cain and Neil Sean are having quite the feud. Journey is currently on the road for their 40th anniversary tour. And these two guys hate each other. They're suing each other over the use of a banned American Express card. Apparently, Neil Sean was using it to buy furniture or whatever for himself. And Jonathan Cain didn't like that. So they put a freeze on the credit card. And now they have armed guards outside of their respective dressing rooms while they're on tour together. So it's really turned into quite the thing between the two. And together, they wrote one of the most classic rock anthems of all time.
I mean, that was all going on while they wrote this.
No, that was all going on after, before this last tour, during COVID times. Apparently, Neil Sean took the banned American Express card, went and just racked up a whole bunch of charges on it. And Jonathan Cain was like, what the fuck you doing? That's the band's money, not just your money. Any sort of purchases need to be approved. So he kind of put a stop to the card, and that pissed off Neil Sean and his wife. And now there's this whole big feud going on.
If you stole my American Express card, what would be the wildest thing that you would buy?
I imagine there's like $10 on that card. So, geez, I don't know. What can I get for $10? Well, I'd go to the Come and Go. That's for sure.
Oh, God. You know what? I wouldn't even be mad at you if you did that. Like, I would. Like, if I looked down, I saw like the cards, the Come and Go. I'd be like, oh, good for him.
All right. I just wanted to get that little bit of Journey trivia out of the way here. Let's get into some Steve Perry. Just a small town girl living in a lonely world. She took the midnight train going anywhere. Just a city boy born and raised in South Detroit.
I'm going to give you two options here, and only one of them is right. I don't know the right answer. You're going to tell everybody the right answer because it's going to be your opinion here, Corey.
Okay.
You get one adjective to describe Steve Perry's voice, and it's silky or velvety.
I'm going to go silky.
Silky?
Yeah.
Okay, velvety. Now you got to explain why.
Velvety to me has a little more of a smoky quality to it. It's more of a lounge singer, more of a crooner. Steve Perry, I think, has more power than a crooner. That's why I kind of went towards a silky. Velvety is more of a Mel Torme, you know, maybe even like a Tom Jones, even though Tom Jones has that power. To me, you know, Steve Perry, kind of a different voice than that. That you know, you don't get Steve Perry singing a torch song. He writes anthemic or sings anthemic ballads and big rock songs. So I'm going to go silky. Now you can tell me why I'm wrong.
No. This wasn't a trap at all. This was legitimately, like, I wanted your opinion on it. I like that you said silky, though, because especially bringing in the power, you don't think of silk as powerful until you try to break it or rip it. And you can't, right? It's a very strong material. And I really like the way that you kind of put that for those reasons. It was something that was in my head because I'm listening. I'm like, I wanted to call it velvety. I wanted to call it silky. I'm like, you know what? I'm going to put it on Corey. I'm not going to take this kind of responsibility in my life right now. So it wasn't a trap at all. It was really just me passing the buck.
Well, thanks. I'm glad I passed the audition. Thank you. I just want to mention real quick, our friend Scott Haskett isn't here, but I'm sure he's one of those Detroiters who would take umbrage to the line, born and raised in South Detroit, because there is no place in Detroit commonly called South Detroit.
Well, what would you call it then?
Just Detroit.
So all of Detroit's Detroit? There's no South part?
Well, I'm reading an explanation here. The city lies mainly on the north bank of the Detroit River, and directly south of its downtown core is Windsor, Ontario. And I've been to Windsor. You can look across the river, and you're looking right at the heart of downtown Detroit. So there really is no South Detroit, because the last thing, there's no residential past the city center, I think is what they're getting at. So born and raised in South Detroit would be a Little Caesars by the hockey rink there.
Yeah, but maybe like his mom was really trashy and like kind of like the Jay and Silent Bob movie where like they get raised outside the grocery store or whatever the quickie mart.
Well, maybe, right? Yeah,
so maybe it's that kind of situation of like born and raised in front of Little Caesars.
Is there a come and go in South Detroit, maybe?
Right, so maybe you're really trying to paint the picture there, Corey.
I can get on board with that. Now Steve Perry said, and I quote, "I tried North Detroit, I tried East and West, and it didn't sing, but South Detroit sounded so beautiful. I love the way it sounded, only to find out later it's actually Canada." So so born and raised in South Detroit is Windsor.
I mean, that's kind of remarkable and funny all at the same time.
I have my wife has family who lives in Windsor. It's a lovely city. A singer in a smoky room, a smell of wine and cheap perfume. For a smile they can share the night. It goes on and on and on and on. Strangers waiting up and down the boulevard. Their shadows searching in the night. Streetlights, people John, you're a big karaoke guy. Can you hit that note?
Holy fuck, right? These aren't, like, I'm not going to shit on the lyrics. They're not as remarkable as the way they're being sung, though, right? Like, if I were just saying it, right? Strange is waiting up and down the boulevard. The shadows searching in the night, right? It's very flat.
Mm-hmm.
But how Steve Perry crafts a song with his voice, right? It's almost like these need to be basic building blocks. Because if these were complicated words, you'd be like, what is he singing? Mm-hmm. But he enunciates really well. You understand exactly what he's saying. It's painting a picture. But his vibrato, right? Like is really emphasizing, like, the way I can never say night the way Steve Perry says night. Like, I'm like, good night, moon, right? And Steve Perry's like, night, right? Like, it's two totally different animals.
I tell you, he said it right in that quote I read. He tried East and West, and it didn't sing. He's looking for words that sing, that he could build into his repertoire. And welcome to Steve fucking Perry. He takes flat lyrics and makes them epic all the time. Listen to Oh Sherry. Well, what the hell are the lyrics to that thing? Well, I should have been gone. Like, there's nothing to that song. Oh Sherry, I'm in love. Hold on. It's the chorus. But he makes it sound like it's being sung by an orchestra.
And again, we're not shitting on the lyrics, right? Like, no. It's very intentional, right? With fancier, more well-devised lyrics, more complicated lyrics, the complexity of his voice doesn't have enough room to breathe. The simplicity of the lyrics allows his voice to become this extra instrument for the band that's filling so much space in the song.
And an odd song structure too, because we have an instrumental and then a verse, and then an instrumental break, and then another verse, and then this pre-chorus, and then usually the pre-chorus leads into the chorus, but it doesn't. We go back to an instrumental, then another verse. We don't get the chorus till the end of the song.
Yeah, and the chorus is like what you're waiting the entire song for.
Yeah.
Like, in your head, the entire song is the chorus, but you only wrap up with it.
That's true.
I want to stop on that verse and talk about the movie for a minute.
Yep.
Because if you look at those lyrics, I think those lyrics, like, Don't Stop Believing is very much about this, what was it, 2001 A's team?
2002, I believe. Oh, yeah. 2001, they made the American League Divisional Series and lost to the Yankees, and the team got gutted.
Yeah, the team got gutted. So it's the 2002 team. But before that, there's a prologue to the movie that shows Billy Beane in the minor leagues, and shows Billy Beane as like this can't miss prospect that misses, right? And he carries that weight with him, right? So I see some will win, some will lose. That's kind of the theme of the movie, right? Because Billy Beane takes players like himself, who are labeled losers by the other ball clubs, and builds a winner out of them, right? And I think it's really poignant that, A, he has this history, right? And if you haven't seen this movie and you're this far in the podcast, A, what are you doing? B, go and watch this movie and come back and listen to the rest of this podcast. I know we all want to hear the song. Song's in the movie too. But, you know, Billy Beane, you know, was what they call like a 5-2 outfielder, which means he can run, he can hit, he can throw, he can field, and whatever the fifth, like, I can't do off the top of my head anymore. 20 years ago, I knew all five tools. Somebody's going to tweet at me and be like, you say you like fantasy baseball. Listen, we're recording this 10 o'clock at night. Corey and I just worked a full day of work, and we're both cranky old dads. So if I'm missing one of the five tools in baseball right now, right, and you're gonna give me shit, by all means, do it on Twitter and make sure you make the show more popular. That's all I ask.
One of my favorite parts of the movie goes back to Billy Beane, and when he's interviewing Jonah Hill's character, Peter Brand, and Billy Beane was the first overall pick by the Mets, if I remember correctly, way back in the 80s.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, he was.
And he asked Brand, if you're such a great evaluator of talent, where would you have drafted me where the Mets did? And Brand said, I wouldn't have drafted you until the ninth round. And then Beane said, you're hired, because he didn't pan out. Yeah.
No, and it was all based on what his statistics were and not the look and feel of the player, which there is a time and the place for that kind of analytics in baseball. But putting it all over baseball is also the wrong thing. And I will keep coming back to this till we talk about a movie that doesn't focus so much on the analytics. However, the job that Billy Beane does this particular season, building this particular team, is nothing short of a miracle, because he was given nothing to work with. All of his all-star players were taken or traded to other teams because he wasn't given the budget. Mm-hmm. The budget he was given didn't even allow for amenities in the locker room for the players, typical ones that all baseball clubhouses have. Right,
like a pop machine. The pop machine. I remember the play David Justice when he came in. He's like, "How come I can't get a pop?" Like, "Oh, you got to pay a buck." He's like, "You got to pay to get drinks here."
But right, like other locker rooms have like catering, have like, you know, it's like almost like being on a movie set, right? And you know, there's like a bowl full of like the green M&Ms, for instance. Right? Sometimes it's not the M&Ms in the bowl, but that's another podcast. But there's also all these amenities that players were used to, and a guy like David Justice, who was an all-star many years ago and now is on the back nine of his career and just trying to, you know, be relevant in the game, and he comes to this locker room with no amenities, and he's like, what are you talking about? What is this franchise? Where am I? But yet he wants to still have a place in the game, so he's there.
Yeah.
And he absolutely contributes to that team.
And the biggest name on the team, you talk about some of the players who left after the 2001 season, Johnny Damon, Jason Giambi, Jason Isringhausen are three pretty big names right there. And who did they bring in? David Justice, Scott Hatterberg, and Jeremy Giambi, Jason's brother.
You know, who was a good player, but was not the all-star player and top flight, like blue chip player his brother was. Mm-hmm. Right? Like when you're talking about our blue chip players, David Justice, of the guys that you mentioned, David Justice was the only blue chip player, but he was a blue chip player like 5 years earlier.
And with bad knees, right?
That's what I mean. Like he was at a point in his career where his knees were bad. He wasn't a regular player anymore. He was more of a contributor. He was more like, he went from being a middle of the lineup guy who carried your team to like, all right, he's the veteran presence here who could be our clubhouse leader, but more like Jake Taylor in Major League, where he's really on his last leg, and you know, you're just getting whatever you can out of his tank at this point. Before we get into the guitar solo, so he sings, you know, the night twice in that pre-chorus, And it always plays on my emotions that he goes soft and silky on the first one. So I'm waiting for him to belt it out on the second one. I always want to jump the gun. Do you go through that same thing?
You know what? I could see. I don't recall ever doing that. This song is just so ingrained in my DNA. But I can see where you're coming from. But I like the silk and smooth on the first one before he goes full on power on the second one.
You like watching me with the song, and I just get so spastically excited about it. Like, people aren't seeing our video, but like you're watching me, and it's like I'm if this were a wrestling show, I'd be cheering for somebody to hit somebody with a chair right now, right? Corey could kind of fill you in on the behind the scenes, but I am wearing it on my sleeve with the song.
Oh, I'm signing up for a YouTube channel as we speak, as you're singing this song, so we can start doing the video podcast that people can see you rocking out to Don't Stop Believing and this excellent guitar solo with this amazing guitar tone.
I can't wait.
Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, I can't wait. Let's hear the guitar. And then you stopped it so we could hear me again, but I just want to hear the guitar.
Well, you started talking. I didn't want to cut you off. I'm going to back it up a little bit.
That's one of the most iconic guitar solos. And I know there's not a lot to it, and people could sit there and argue about who's the great guitarist of all times. Those riffs in that guitar solo are so iconic.
It's really true. Speaking of iconic, let's finish up our discussion of the movie here a little bit. We're getting close to the end of the song. Let's talk about the end of the movie. Our sad sack Oakland Athletics win the American League West in 2002, but they lose to the Twins in the division series. And in the film, they actually have a baseball analyst talking about what you're talking about. The one thing Moneyball doesn't take into account, and that's drive and clutch performances and momentum and heart and all that kind of stuff. And that's why Moneyball won't be the be-all end-all. And Brand gets offered, was it $12 million, $12.5 million to be the GM of the Boston Red Sox, and he turns it down, saying, you know, he's not going to be happy until they change baseball and Moneyball wins them a World Series, which as of this taping in 2023 has not happened yet.
No, and not just that, other teams have taken on Moneyball, and I'll use my Yankees as an example. My Yankees have full on embraced Moneyball, and they haven't won a World Series since 2009. So, you know, say what you will about the concept of Moneyball, there's something to be said about the best players on the field. Like you can't top, if a team can outspend you, it's very hard to win in baseball. It can be done, but it's very hard. But the other thing is, there is just something about those intangibles, right? Like, one of my favorite players is Derek Jeter. By no means is Derek Jeter the statistically best shortstop of his generation or most other generations. But when he's asked who's the best shortstop of his generation, his answer is, well, we won. And my answer is, if you were to ask me who the best shortstop is, he was the captain of the New York Yankees. And they named him the captain after most of the veterans he played with and won championships with left. But he carried a leadership, including that 2009 team that did win. And he carried himself as a captain before he was named captain. And I think there's something to be said about those kind of intangibles, those kind of leadership skills that go beyond what you see, right? If you're down two games to none and you're in the locker room, I don't care what statistics you have on your side. If you get down and you don't have that leadership to pull you out and say, it ain't over, we just have to win today. We'll win today, and then we'll deal with tomorrow. That's what leadership is. And that has nothing to do with stats in baseball.
All right, Don't Stop Believing by Journey from the album Escape and the film Moneyball. Journey is currently still out there touring. Neil Sean, Jonathan Cain, we talked about. Dean Castronovo on drums, a longtime drummer for them since 98. Arnel Pineda on vocals since 2007, taking over from Steve Perry. There was a great documentary on Journey that chronicled them finding Arnel Pineda and bringing him into the band. Good stuff.
He does a fantastic job, and that's a fantastic documentary.
It really is, and it's kind of warts and all, because it shows him struggling early because he's not a classically trained singer. He had to kind of get into concert shape. Like, he'd run out of air, you know, halfway through the set, and you know, guess what's coming up at the end of the set? Songs like "Don't Stop Believin'." You got to save a little in the gas tank, kid.
Well, and you know what? It's a credit to his talent, and it's a credit to his poise and his ability that he got there, right? Because there's no doubt, like, when you see him on YouTube or something, he has the talent, but there's training involved to get through a concert show. And like you said, the documentary does a great job at showing what it takes to get there.
Mm-hmm. All right, John, anything else we want to talk about Moneyball before we call it a night?
No, look, I love and adore this movie. I actually really enjoyed rooting for the A's. As much as I'm a Yankee fan, it's a team I like to root for because they're an underdog, you know. And as much as I shit on some of the Moneyball stat games that they play, it's like, look, it'd be great to see them win one, you know, because they don't have another avenue. It annoys me when bigger franchises that have other avenues are taking this avenue. It's like, no, let them have their thing, and still keep baseball as baseball. And see if their thing can beat you.
Yeah, absolutely. I love Moneyball. It's a great movie. Nominated for a few Academy Awards back in the day, if I remember correctly. Made $110 million at the box office. It was a great 1-2 punch for Aaron Sorkin. He wrote The Social Network, won the Academy Award for that the year before, and then followed that up with the script for Moneyball. Absolutely fantastic movie. We recommend everybody, even if you're not a baseball fan. My wife's not a baseball fan, but she greatly enjoyed Moneyball. It's got a little bit of something for everybody. It's got a great cast. Philip Seymour Hoffman as Art Howe is a real standout for me in this one.
Oh, yeah. He does such a great job as Art Howe. Like, if you're a baseball fan and you're familiar with Art Howe as a manager, and if you're not, you can probably find videos online of him. Absolutely embodies him. Like Brad Pitt embodies Billy Bean, right? It's such a well-cast movie. And Sorkin goes on such a run here. Like, with The Social Network too in there, right? Like, mm-hmm. What I'm learning tonight, or I'm realizing tonight, is we're going to cover a lot of Aaron Sorkin on this podcast at some point.
Ooh, The Trial of Chicago 7 was one of his later ones. I don't know, Netflix a couple of years ago.
I watched it during the pandemic. I was going to say, just watched it. Pandemic's a couple of years ago now. Yeah. I watched it. Sacha Baron Cohen has an incredible performance in that movie.
Really great movie. Yep, totally. And Aaron Sorkin directed that, if I remember correctly. Yep. So we'll have that to look forward to, too. But until then, John, where can the folks find you? And what do you got on the go?
You can find me drafting 4 fantasy baseball teams at the end of the month. Because I am a serious player, and I play not really for serious money, but I do take the game really seriously. I love baseball, and this was an absolute blast to tie all of this stuff together, including fucking Journey, Tori.
Fucking Journey. Don't forget to load up on Blue Jays in those drafts, Johnny. And if you want more of me, you can find me on Twitter @CD Morissette. You can also find the show at BT Theme Music. Well, of course, we're part of the Deep Dive Podcast Network and all the great shows on there. Head on over to deepdivepodcastnetwork.com. Check out all the shows. Give them your support. And thank you for supporting us. We don't have the biggest audience in the world, but we have a very loyal audience. We're getting a lot of compliments lately that making John and I feel good about doing the show. It's my favorite show to do out of all the shows I do because I get to talk about two things I love more than anything, music and movies, with one of my best friends in the world. So on behalf of John Mariano, my name is Corey Morissette. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you next time on Backtracks Theme Music.
Okay, people who run ball clubs, they think in terms of buying players. Your goal shouldn't be to buy players. Your goal should be to buy wins. And in order to buy wins, you need to buy runs. You're trying to replace Johnny Damon. The Boston Red Sox see Johnny Damon and they see a star who's worth $7.5 million a year. When I see Johnny Damon, what I see is an imperfect understanding of where runs come from. The guy's got a great glove. He's a decent leadoff hitter. He can steal bases, but is he worth the $7.5 million a year that the Boston Red Sox are paying him? No. No. Baseball thinking is medieval. They are asking all the wrong questions. And if I say it to anybody, I'm ostracized. I'm a leper, so that's why I'm cagey about this with you. That's why I respect you, Mr. Bean. And if you want full disclosure, I think it's a good thing that you got Damon off of your payroll. I think it opens up all kinds of interesting possibilities.
Where are you from, Pete?
Maryland.
Where'd you go to school?
Yale. I went to Yale.
What'd you study?
Economics. I studied economics.
Yale, economics, and baseball. You're funny, Pete.